Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The government's ambitious plan to inoculate as many Americans as possible against H1N1 swine flu is underway. First in line, children, healthcare workers, pregnant women, and people with chronic conditions. So far, no serious side effects have been reported. The public still has plenty of questions. We've brought in some of the country's top experts for answers. This hour, On Point, questions and answers on H1N1 and the swine flu vaccine. Joining me first today with the latest on the vaccine rollout is Maggie Fox, health and science editor for Reuters News Service. Maggie, thanks very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. My pleasure.
So first, you quote a top CDC official recently, Tom Frieden, saying, "We haven't had a flu season like this in at least 50 years. What does he mean by that, Maggie?
He's referring to the pandemic at the end of the 50s. There was a pandemic of influenza in 1957-58. And what Dr. Frieden is saying is that this is a pandemic that kind of looks like that. There's been one pandemic since then in the late 60s, but it was a little milder than this one.
What's the difference between a pandemic and ordinary seasonal flu?
Well, seasonal flu, as the name implies, comes every single year. Every year we have seasonal flu. Every once in a while, there's a brand new virus that pops up that nobody or very few people have immunity to, so it spreads to more people and infects more people. Sometimes that flu is a worse flu than the seasonal flu as well. Sometimes it makes people sicker and kills more people, but the definition of a pandemic means it's new and it can infect almost everyone.
So what are we seeing so far? Swine flu, H1N1, hit the headlines early this year. Got a lot of attention. We've got some experience with this strain now. What do we see so far, Maggie, in who's getting sick and the outcomes of illness?
Well, it is different than seasonal flu. A, it's been circulating all summer, and flu usually goes away in the summer. It is infecting younger people than seasonal flu usually does. Usually the very young and the very old are the most vulnerable to flu. Now we see perfectly healthy young adults and older children becoming very sick with this flu. It's also affecting the normal people who are at high risk of flu anytime, like pregnant women. But we're seeing more cases in people who are theoretically at risk of flu who you don't hear about in a normal flu season, like people with chronic diseases, people with asthma, people with diabetes. A lot of the deaths, there have been 76 deaths among children, and these are disabled children, many of them, not all of them, but many of them have been children with muscular dystrophy, cerebral palsy. So it's a different pattern than you see with seasonal flu.
And what about the virulence of this compared to seasonal flu? You're reporting on a CDC study looking at 272 patients sick enough to be hospitalized. 25% of them ended up in intensive care and 7% died. That sounds scary, but I guess it's a small percentage that end up in hospital.
That's true. But even with seasonal flu, a small percentage of the population in hospital adds up to 200,000 people a year in the United States alone in the hospital with flu. Now, when you look at that number, it's often people over 65. What is upsetting officials and has them concerned is that now this flu is infecting younger people. School children, young adults, people of working age who are, even if this flu is no worse than seasonal flu, these are people who wouldn't be in the hospital otherwise, who are.
So what's the rollout for the vaccination program? It started just in the last week or 10 days. Who's getting what, how much, and what's the ultimate goal?
Well, the ultimate goal is 160 million people at the minimum, the CDC's designated priority groups, and these are the people who are at the highest risk of getting very sick from the flu, which includes pregnant women. They want to put healthcare workers at the front of the line, both because they're more likely to be infected just because they're contacting sick people, but also so they don't spread the flu to their vulnerable patients. School-aged children are at the front of the line, and these people with chronic diseases who seem to be at higher risk of complications. Now, the U.S. government has opted to go ahead and start rolling out the vaccine as soon as it becomes available. And this is a bit of a gamble because what it means is that it's bumpy and patchy because the companies are trying to get this flu vaccine made. They have to put it into bottles. It has to be inspected by the U.S. Food and Drug Drug Administration, and then distributed. The states have to get their acts together and actually order the vaccine that they want. So what's happened is in the first week of vaccination, the only vaccine that was available immediately was this MedImmune vaccine, which everybody's seen pictures of now, kids and healthcare workers getting it squirted up their nose.
The flu mist, it's often called.
Well, flu mist is the name of the vaccine for the seasonal flu. That's the brand name.
Okay.
I'm not sure if that's the same brand name for the H1N1, but it's the flu mist vaccine. It's the same delivery mechanism for that. And as the other companies get their stuff packaged and rolled out and the states get it ordered and the distributors get it to the places that will be delivering the vaccine, like doctor's offices, like your local pharmacy, like if your supermarket is offering vaccines, if your workplace is offering vaccines, that'll be rolled out, but it's patchy.
Is the assumption that it will ultimately be out there and soon enough in enough volume for everybody who's particularly vulnerable to get it? Is there a shortage here or not ultimately on the horizon?
Ultimately, the U.S. government tells us there will not be a shortage. Ultimately, they have ordered 250 million doses of vaccine. There are 300 million Americans, but their experience with flu vaccines is that not everybody gets a vaccine, especially if people aren't frightened by this flu. People tend to wait and see what it looks like, wait and see if it's in their neighborhood, if they know anybody who got sick. So they're pretty confident that will be enough for everybody who actually will show up for one.
And how are people supposed to get this? For example, if you have school-aged children, will it come to you, to your family, or does each individual family have to reach out to some medical provider and secure it for themselves, for their children?
It depends on where you live. There are some jurisdictions. I live in Maryland, and Maryland was offering vaccines at certain schools where the kids could just go to school and get them. In other jurisdictions, yes, you have to go find your pediatrician and get the vaccine. As more becomes available, probably some retailers will offer it, so you can go down to the pharmacy and get it or go down to Walmart and get it. It will be different in different places.
And what about, there have been questions still raised on Safety and Polls show Americans aren't quite sure about this vaccine. What do you see in those polls, Maggie?
Well, the polls are all over the place. There was a Consumer Reports poll that showed a great deal of skepticism that most people did not fully intend to get the vaccine and didn't intend to vaccinate their children. But the Harvard School of Public Health did a poll, and it showed that 75% of Americans plan to vaccinate their children and 53% plan to get the vaccine for themselves. I think a lot of it depends on how the question is asked, which is always the case with polls, of course, because the Harvard people also asked, are you really, really sure you're going to get it, and you won't change your mind no matter what? And then those numbers went down. But I think almost anyone would take a more cautious answer when asked in that way. I think Americans are uncertain, and they're going to wait and see what they want to do.
What is the CDC saying about safety? I assume it's a full assurance. They're putting this out.
They're very, very, very confident that this is safe. There have been a lot of meetings about this vaccine, and it's based on the same formula that's used for the seasonal vaccine every year. Every year, a new flu vaccine has to be made anyway because influenza mutates all the time, constantly. And there's meetings that go on all year round with the flu experts who watch and see what's circulating, and they decide which precise flu strain they're going to put in the vaccine, which three strains, they usually put three in there, to match the most closely the circulating vaccine. They have treated the H1N1 the same way. Even though it's a whole new virus to our immune systems, it's still a flu virus, it's still influenza. You make the vaccine the same way you make the seasonal flu vaccine, which has been administered with very, very, very few complications for many years now.
Maggie Fox with Reuters News Service, health and science editor there. Maggie, thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
We are talking about H1N1, swine flu, and the vaccine. We're going to hear from a couple of the country's top authorities on the flu and how the nation is addressing it in this hour. Joining me first from Nashville, Tennessee, we're joined by Dr. William Schaffner, professor and chair of the Department of Preventive Medicine at Vanderbilt University School of Medicine. Tennessee's been particularly hard hit early by H1N1. Dr. Schaffner, welcome back to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Tom. Good to be with you.
So, what are we up against here? Is this big, fierce, and terrible? Is this manageable? I mean, very broad stroke. Are we facing something, you know, out of the box, menacing, or within our sort of public health capacity to deal with? How do you see swine flu?
Well, it's serious. It as you say, down in the southeast, we have been hard hit this winter. We've had lots of school absenteeisms, indeed some school closings. Parents have had to stay home from work. Parents have been ill. Our emergency rooms have been exceedingly busy. So it's clearly important now that we have a vaccine on the horizon and indeed starting to be administered. This vaccine is right on target. Maggie is right. Flu likes to mutate and change, but this virus has not. So we've created a vaccine that's a bullseye vaccine. It's right on target. And as soon as we start vaccinating people, they will be prevented. And I think we can, in public health and in clinical medicine, curtail this outbreak and minimize the impact on people.
What percentage of the American population are authorities like you, experts, hoping get the vaccine, Dr. Stephanie?
Well, the government is contracted for about 250 million doses. I'd like to see not a single dose left in the refrigerator. I'd like that all to go into noses and arms just as quickly as possible.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Liberty Mutual, for auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual, responsibility, what's your policy? And Stonehill College, where many minds gather for one purpose, to educate students for lives that make a difference, near Boston and Easton, Massachusetts. Stonehill.edu.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the H1N1 swine flu vaccine rolling out now and questions around swine flu. We've been joined in this hour by Dr. William Schaffner at Vanderbilt University's School of Medicine, leading authority there on flu and preventive medicine. With us right now from Minneapolis is Michael Osterholm, director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. Michael Osterholm, thank you very much for being with us this hour.
Hi, Tom.
So what are you seeing in this H1N1 pandemic so far? Is this a big killer? Is this a manageable one? To your eye, how are you looking at it?
Well, this really presents all of us in the public health and medical area with a real challenge, because for the vast majority of people, as you've already heard, this is really another influenza season without severe disease, meaning that people are sick for several days and they recover. Absenteeism, of course, becomes an important point. But for a very small group of people, well less than 1%, this is a very serious situation. It's, in essence, almost hell. We're watching intensive care units in many parts of the world basically be taken right to the edge of their capacity. And if the case numbers continue to increase over the next few weeks to months, we're very concerned that they will overrun that capacity, and you'll see a number of increased deaths occurring because of that.
The most vulnerable groups we're being told are young people and pregnant women. It's easy to imagine why pregnant women, though it'd be good if you'd explain that, but why children in particular?
Well, first of all, we're hearing a lot more about the children, but if you actually look at the number of deaths and look at the rate of deaths per population, actually the highest rate of deaths is still in those 20 to 40-year-olds. Oh. And so that surely any death under, the oldest of ages is unfortunate, but it really is in that in the young adult age group. And in fact, this is reminiscent. If you go back and look at the curve that we're seeing, meaning the number of cases plotted over the number of people by age group, mm-hmm. This is actually quite similar to what we saw in 1918 with what we call the W-shaped curve of more fatality, where the very youngest were spared, and then it became much more of a problem in the middle-aged populations and much less in the older population.
This is the flu that killed so many coming home from World War I back in 1918.
Well, actually, it didn't kill just people coming back from World War One. While this is not the same as what happened in 1918, unfortunately, the number of deaths are fewer overall. But in fact, this got its start well before people came back from the war. If you look at and plot out cases by time, the first country in Europe, for example, that was significantly impacted by this was actually Switzerland, which was not even in the war, nor were they sending people to or from the war. So while it surely coincided with World War One, that may enhance the transmission around the world, this did quite well on its own without a war even being present.
Dr. Schaffner, why the vulnerability of young adults? They would, by definition, seem to be the most healthy and robust and invulnerable.
Well, it's really very simple. As Maggie said, it's a new virus. The population in the United States and indeed around the world has not seen this virus before, and so the young and middle-aged are completely vulnerable. Now, people
because they have no immunity, you're saying there.
Exactly. They haven't seen a virus like this before. Mm-hmm. Now, it's paradoxical because those of us with a little gray hair probably saw a virus similar to this in the 1950s, and so we have some residual protection. And that's why this virus is, relatively speaking, sparing older individuals, but has its greatest impact on the young. Now, let me emphasize something that Micah said. This virus will be very dangerous for a subset of the population, a small proportion. Some of them have underlying illnesses, but others are completely healthy. For example, sadly, about now 3 weeks ago, we had a 5-year-old completely healthy come to our pediatric emergency room and die in the emergency room. Young adults.
With all the care that could be brought to bear there and still.
Exactly. And those are extraordinarily tragic circumstances, and we can't pick those folks out in advance. The response to that? Vaccinate everyone.
Michael Osterholm, what do we know so far about the effectiveness of the new vaccine that's being rolled out just starting last week?
Well, we don't have any data on the effectiveness as it relates to preventing cases, of course, because to date, all the studies have basically been done just looking at how does your immune system respond.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't put that into a population yet. We wish we could. We want to get as much out there. But from the effectiveness data as it relates to the immune response, this is a very good vaccine. It's acting just like the other seasonal flu vaccines. It's a good match. Clearly, this virus has not mutated or changed in ways that we sometimes see seasonal flu viruses do with the strain that was picked some 6 to 8 months before the season to make. So in that sense, we have every reason to believe that this is going to be a good vaccine that will provide a quite good protection.
Dr. Schaffner, there's been in public polls some skepticism about the vaccine. I'm not sure why. Do you have any skepticism about the safety of this vaccine yourself? You've been watching flu for a long time. And how do you interpret this thread of public reluctance or skepticism?
I am quite convinced that this is going to be a safe vaccine, just as safe as seasonal flu vaccine. In fact, I'm so convinced that I was a volunteer in the local clinical trials. So I, lined up to get the vaccine early and donate my blood for some of those studies that Mike has mentioned. I think there is always skepticism about any government program, anything new, and there are some people who have heard that everyone has worked so quickly and intensely to get this vaccine ready, which is a good public health message, that they have heard it a little bit differently. They've heard rush. And you know, when we rush around the house, we cut corners. And so that has been misinterpreted. This is manufactured by the same people in the same plants in exactly the same way we make seasonal flu vaccine, which we've given in the hundreds of millions of doses before. This is going to be both safe and, Michael and I agree, an effective vaccine.
Do you have any sense from the speed with which it's been developed that there have been cut corners, shortcuts taken?
No corners have been cut. None.
Period, straight up. Now, Michael, for children, let's say, how do they get this? They're getting the nasal spray, many people right now. Is it a one-shot deal or two? What's the sequence?
Yeah, Tom, this is really being handled much like we would the seasonal flu vaccine, and I just want to come back to a point that Bill made because I think it's really critical that there is a great deal of misinformation out there right now. I think this is a different time. I think that with the age of electronic information, one can take a rumor or a very just straightforward false statement and actually make that go across the airways and impact on many thousands to millions of people. Just last week, I was on a radio talk show where an individual called in and said he had his eyes exactly on a site on the CDC website that said that this vaccine had an adjuvant or a component in the vaccine which doesn't exist. Well, that page does not exist on the CDC website. And it was his word against mine, but for those listening, they'd say, well, you know, maybe I'll wait. Maybe he's right. And so I think that we do have a challenge on our hands that I think is unprecedented in terms of trying to sell a vaccine. So now I look at the issue of parents, and you asked me the question about children.
Mm-hmm.
They should be able to get this vaccine just like any other. If they're taking the nasal spray, then we don't want to do it at the same time we do the seasonal vaccine for at least 3 weeks, but otherwise we want them to get it. What my concern is that there is just such a fragmented delivery system on the end of that pipeline that we have today that we're seeing it's going to be very difficult for many parents to get their children vaccinated quickly in some communities. Some are doing school-based clinics, some are not. Some are allowing only the physician's offices to do it. Some are allowing third parties like pharmacies and so forth to help do it. So it's going to be a challenge in each community to find that vaccine and get it as soon as possible.
Dr. Schaffner, can you walk us through the ABCs of this? Who gets the nasal spray? Who gets the shot? When can people get it? Is it a one-shot delivery, or does it take more than one? Give us the basics, if you would.
Well, first of all, the nasal spray vaccine is the one that's available now, and the injectable vaccine will be available shortly. Nasal spray vaccine is available for people who are range in age from 2 up until their 50th birthday who are otherwise healthy. That's okay. Just the way that vaccine has been licensed. It will take for everyone age 10 and over just one exposure to the vaccine, one nasal spray mm-hmm. or one inoculation. It's likely, still not 100% determined, but it's likely that children under the age of 10 may require two administrations separated by about 2, 3, or 4 weeks to get optimal mm-hmm. protection.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we've all paid for this vaccine. The government has bought it, and the government is distributing it, and it will be sent via local state health departments to locals. There's going to be a fair amount of difference from one state to another about how this is done. And I think it's true. The average parent or the average individual is going to really have to pay attention to the local media to find out when and where the vaccine is available. And they may have to make several attempts to get it as we roll it out shipment by shipment as it spreads out across the country. Public health is ultimately local, and locally people will have to pay attention.
But 250 million doses out there, and you're hoping that they all get used. I want to begin to bring in our listeners. They've got questions for the two of you. Let me go first to Iowa City and Teresa. Teresa, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks, Tom. Yes, my question is, when I was looking through the manufacturer's insert for the flu mist, the seasonal flu mist that my kids have received, mm-hmm. I noticed that there's a strain of the H1N virus included in that. Will that give them any protection against the virus that the specific vaccine for H1N1 is supposed to be protecting them from?
Good question. Michael Osterholm, the standard seasonal flu, in this case nasal spray, flu mist, does it give any protection against the swine flu, H1N1?
Unfortunately, it doesn't. So we're really dealing with two different H1N1s this year, one which is from the old vaccine approach in which that one circulated before this new one emerged in Mexico. We wished it did, but it doesn't. You need both.
Is there this time, waiting time between the two, Dr. Schaffner? When you get the regular seasonal mist or shot, do you need to wait before you get H1N1?
Yes, you do. You can't administer the two seasonal flu mists at the same time. You have to wait at least 2 weeks. However, you could get seasonal and H1N1 simultaneously by inoculation, or get one by inoculation and the other via mist. That could be done right at the same time.
Now, why didn't they just combine these into one vaccination? It seems like it would have been a lot simpler.
It sure would have, except that the H1N1 virus suddenly reared its head in April and May. And by that time, the seasonal vaccine had already almost been completely made. So it was too late to combine the two.
Just too late, no way around it. 250 million, is that a standard number of doses? Is that what we have for seasonal flu as well, or is that more for H1N1?
It's more, a lot more. Last year we gave about 90 million doses of influenza vaccine in the United States, and we were doing pretty well. We'd like to have given more. So 250 million doses is substantially more than we usually do, and we hope the public takes advantage of it. Vaccine left in the refrigerator has never prevented a single case of influenza.
We're talking
think,
about...
Tom,
yes,
I think,
Michael.
Tom, one of the really critical pieces to this whole equation is not just will we have a dose for everybody in this country or for that matter around the world, but when will they get it? And we're in a race right now against this virus. For those of us who are out here in the field, we're seeing the rapid increase in cases that are occurring literally every day. And so the longer it takes us to get this vaccine out to the public means that that's just one more missed opportunity to prevent infection. And so I think we have to be careful about giving people all this sense that we have a dose of vaccine for everybody. We do, in a sense, but it's not going to help us if we can't get it out there before they all get sick. And that's what we're really racing against right now.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. What kind of date do you have in mind or target when you say racing? I mean, by when does this need to be used, Michael Osterholm?
Well, yesterday would have been a good date to have had that happen. I think this is one of the challenges that we're seeing, and this is one of the concerns that I think we have to be careful as our message is going out about getting this vaccine. For example, we're hearing from a number of physicians' offices that are really upset and complaining to the public health community that their phone lines are overrun with people calling for the vaccine, and they can't get their regular patients even to talk to a receptionist, let alone to get in to be seen, because they're tying up the phone lines. We need to have a better system, which we don't right now, so we have to make do with what we have. One, I think an important message is listen carefully to public notices in your local area about when vaccine is there and who has it. For example, in our community right now, here in the Twin Cities metropolitan area, only very limited locations have this, and what we don't want to have happen is to tie up the rest of the public health and medical communities with this information. At the same time, you just heard me say get it as soon as you can, so we need to help the public be very informed of when and where it's at and who can get it. And I worry about this, quite honestly, as being potentially the Achilles heel of this entire effort. I think the U.S. government did a remarkable job of, as you heard here, moving forward as quickly as possible with this vaccine development and manufacturing process without taking any shortcuts. Now, however, this faucet out here, this rusty faucet into this pipeline is a problem. We have no vaccine for adult program in this country. We have a public health system that has lost 10,000 employees in the last year. We have a medical care system that's in disarray. We've seen many clinics out there having to let staff go over the last year because of just the tight budget issues. There is no elasticity. There is no surge capacity in many communities around our country. We see school-based clinics not being offered in many areas because of the fact we have no school nurses left. We have nobody in the schools to do this. So we're really up against a really high-ledged cliff here about trying to get this out quickly. And everyone's trying to do the best job they can, but the public has to understand this is going to be a challenge over the next few weeks.
William Schaffner, if the health care system doesn't get it out in sufficient volume quickly enough, what's the danger here?
Well, Mike is absolutely right. It will be a strain, and it continues to be a strain, but everybody's doing the best they can, and we need to cut everybody a little bit of slack because everybody's working on this as hard as they can. You're going to see, if we can't get the vaccine out, obviously much more illness, social disruption in terms of school closings and the like, pressure on intensive care units and on emergency rooms. Everybody has been preparing for this, and they've been coping. We've been hit hard, and so far the system, although strained, is holding and working well. Our pediatric emergency room has made modifications. They've pulled pediatricians from other specialties to help in the emergency room. We're hanging in there. We're functioning okay. Our intensive care units are managing to deal with all the patients. So far, so good.
But we saw tents outside in Memphis, if I recall correctly, from TV reporting down there. I mean, it's already hit some hospitals hard.
And that's part of the innovative response.
Mm-hmm.
Put a tent out in front of the emergency room, put some medical personnel there, do triage. In other words, screen people so the most seriously ill folks can be seen most quickly. Other people can be given reassurance and sent home. We're doing okay.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Loomis Sayles, researching and investing for institutions and individuals with a sustained commitment to giving back to the community. More at loomissayles.com. And the Music Emporium, for 40 years offering collectible boutique and vintage acoustic guitars, themusicemporium.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the H1N1 swine flu vaccine rolling out now. We're joined this hour by Dr. William Schaffner. He's professor and chair of the Department of Preventive Medicine at Vanderbilt University School of Medicine, joining us from Nashville, Tennessee today. And from Minneapolis, Minnesota, Michael Osterholm is with us. He's director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. You can join us at 800-423-TALK. With your questions, and let's go right to Alex in Boston. Hi, Alex. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
My question is more has to do with the manufacturing process of the vaccine. My question is, who's producing it? What's the process like? And who's quality controlling the players involved in producing this virus?
What's your personal situation, Alex? Are you and your family being vaccinated? Do you know what?
I'm on the fence. I'm a 40-year-old male. I'm on the fence for myself, but I've got a 20-month-old son, and I've got my wife who's 6 months pregnant, so I'm really concerned about all of the hearsay that's out there about, you know, the good and the bad of this virus. Should we get it? Should we not? Is it just really blown up in the media? But what I want to know more about is really who's monitoring this process of manufacturing, and how do we know that it's not being manufactured in, I don't know, say China or something?
All right, let's pick it up. Michael Osterholm, we'll come to you first. I mean, he's got a lot of skin in this game. 40 years old, 20-month-old child, and a wife 6 months pregnant. Alex has everything to gain or lose here, and he wants to go deeper into how it's being made and how we know it's safe. What do you say to him, Michael?
Well, first of all, it has to be made abundantly clear that this is being made and monitored by the FDA just like it does seasonal flu vaccine every year. And as you've heard earlier in this show, each year worldwide we give upwards of over 200 million doses of that seasonal flu vaccine to people around the world, and we've had a several decade track record of a very safe and effective vaccine process. So none of the shortcuts have been taken that have been reported by many in the what I call the electronic world out there. The FDA has followed every quality review process. Now, having said that, most of the vaccine, unfortunately, is made outside of the United States. We wish we had more capacity here. We're trying to build that capacity, but that has nothing to do about safety or quality. That has everything to do about access. Let me just summarize this for you, and with all that I know, and I have been involved in public health for 30 years, including back in 1976 when we had the swine flu situation back then, I am very aware of everything going on here. I have a 31-year-old daughter who is 6 months pregnant with my first grandchild. She is a pediatrician here at the University of Minnesota. She is awash right now in H1N1 virus activity. I can't tell you how at night I lay there just praying for the day that she is going to get that immunization. Now, hopefully it's going to come very soon in the next several days when we start to get more vaccine here in the state of Minnesota. And so I'm coming from the same perspective that our caller is coming from, as somebody who's emotionally very tied to this, has a lot of skin in the game, and yet I'm making that decision based on that science side of my brain, which knows all about the safety and concern issues. So I would say you don't want to risk your young child or your pregnant wife's lives by not getting that vaccine any more than you would take both of them, putting them in your car, and not encourage them to use their seatbelt, even though, you know, it may not ever be needed in their lifetime. But when they need it, it's the difference between life and death, and that's what this vaccine is all about.
William Schaffner, that's a very strong endorsement of the vaccination, and yet you hear in our caller Alex's question this sort of fear that somehow this stuff is just being swirled up in a bucket in China. What more can you tell us about where and who makes this and how the quality control works?
So Tom, Michael and I are exactly on the same page. We're just trying to provide as much reassurance as possible. These vaccines are being made by the same five manufacturers that make our seasonal vaccine. They have vast expertise in doing this, and they are supervised at absolutely every stage of the production process by rigorous Food and Drug Administration constraints and procedures. Alex, who's 40, his 20-month-year-old son, and his wife, who's pregnant, all have an indication for receiving H1N1 vaccine and seasonal influenza vaccine. It's very important. 28 pregnant women have died so far of H1N1. Over 100 have been admitted to intensive care units. It's not generally known, for example, that pregnant women have, if they get influenza, a risk of complications that are comparable to people 65 and older. That's very important to think about. And the only way to prevent that is to vaccinate them and to vaccinate everyone around them.
This is because their immune system is compromised by pregnancy, or because the pressure that the fetus puts on the internal organs or the lungs?
Yes and yes, Tom. Mm-hmm. Their immune system is somewhat compromised because they have to tolerate that fetus, right? Mm-hmm. They don't want to reject the fetus.
Right.
Number
mm-hmm.
two, as the pregnancy increases, obviously the enlarging uterus pushes up on the diaphragm and mm-hmm. compresses the lung, which makes it more difficult to clear the lung. And thirdly, during the later stages of pregnancy, as every pregnant woman will tell you, they accumulate fluid, and a wet lung is a setup for the complication of pneumonia.
Let's go to Connie in Warren, Vermont. Good luck, Alex. Connie, you're on the air.
Hi. I just read on the internet and heard people discuss the possibility that Guillain-Barré syndrome could be a result with some people for the H1N1 injection, and that when a few decades ago when the swine flu was also present and vaccines were given, that there was a rise in the incidence of Guillain-Barré syndrome.
Going back to 1976, let us pick it up, Connie. Michael Osterholm, what about it?
Well, first of all, let me say that I was intimately involved with that situation. It was my office mate at the Minnesota Department of Health that actually placed that first call to the CDC, suggesting that we had this unusual cluster of people about 2 weeks after the fact developing this very rare neurologic kind of condition.
And this is 1976, when a swine flu vaccine was distributed.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And all we can tell you is that the subsequent investigations clearly demonstrated a marked increase in swine flu vaccine recipients getting Guillain-Barré syndrome in a period roughly several days to up to 2 to 3 weeks after getting that. But it was at a rate of about 1 per million or 1 per 100,000 vaccinees. Now, why that occurred, it's not completely clear yet. And we have to be honest about that. We have some very good ideas and theories, and we know that the vaccine was manufactured in a different way to some degree than it is today. But I think what's really important is, remember, one of the earlier callers made note that they have H1N1 strains in the current seasonal flu vaccine. It's not the same strain we're dealing mm-hmm. with here. But that, in fact, we have been giving that vaccine for the past several decades to hundreds of millions of people each year. And in the process of doing that, we have not seen the same risk of Guillain-Barré syndrome occurring. And so we have to be honest and say we can't tell you with absolute certainty that, in fact, this vaccine will never cause anyone to have some kind of a reaction or something happen. It would be irresponsible to say that. But we can tell you that the data are compelling to suggest the safety of this vaccine, and that in fact, it is not one where we expect to see any of these kinds of situations occur. We can tell you with certainty that, in fact, there is bad disease out there. And again, we talked about it earlier in the show that while it's still a rare occurrence, when it happens, it is very significant. And so, you know, when you add all these risks together and all the concerns and all the considerations, all the data we have, it clearly comes out very strongly in support of, I'd rather take my risk with getting that vaccine.
Let's get a call from Toronto, Canada. Roger, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Two quick questions. How long does it take after getting vaccinated for you to have immunity?
Mm-hmm. Yes, and number two?
And isn't it true that although some portion of the older population has some immunity to this virus, for the portion that do not have such immunity, the disease is just as severe or perhaps more so than it would be in other age groups?
Good questions. Dr. Schaffner, how long does it take for the vaccine to become effective, and what about seniors?
Well, Roger is exactly right that when H1N1 affects people who are older than 65, it is just as ominous as the seasonal. And therefore, although the older persons are not asked to go to the front of the line to get their H1N1 vaccine, when it becomes more widely available, we are asking them to be vaccinated also for their own protection. It will take about 7 days, 10 days to 2 weeks for your immune system to respond and provide optimal protection.
And how late into the season, because this won't be available for everyone right away, how late is it worthwhile getting the vaccine? I mean, if not by Halloween, then by Thanksgiving. If not by Thanksgiving, by Christmas or New Year's? How late is it worthwhile, Dr. Shepard?
Well, yeah, Tom, let me make two points. First, as regards seasonal, let's talk about seasonal first. Remember, seasonal influenza usually peaks in January and February, so we can keep getting seasonal vaccine beyond Thanksgiving, beyond Christmas, and into January, and still have it be effective. As to H1N1, let's get as much out there as possible, and then in your local area, you will be able to track how abundant H1N1 is. And so there will be parts of the country that probably haven't been affected by December, at least not hugely, and so there's still opportunities to get vaccinated.
Let's get a call from Canaan in New York. Wendy, you're on the air.
I'm a registered nurse. Mm-hmm. I'm actually in case management, so I'm not in patient contact very often. But we've been mandated by the state commissioner and the governor that we will get the vaccine or we will be terminated from our jobs, which means, you know, my career is destroyed. And my understanding is that the commissioner's not getting it. I've been told that this will be an annual thing, not just this year, which makes me highly suspicious. I've had adverse effects from the Lyme vaccine, which I received before they yanked it off the market. So while I care very much about the patients, I'm very concerned about the slippery slope. I'm concerned about, I've heard that there was immunity that was legislated for the pharmaceuticals for damages. I just feel that this is a real assault, and I'm thinking about it, I'm considering it, but I don't like being forced, and like I say, it will destroy my career.
If you don't take it and have repercussions.
Right, and I also think it would be nice if we had universal health care so that people that are sick with the flu could get care and have it paid for by our government. There's, you know, I remember when they were mandating the anthrax, which they backed off on. So I'm suspicious, I'm nervous, I'm anxious, I don't trust the government. I know the government lies. They've lied to us about so many other things.
We hear that nervousness, Wendy, and I thank you for your call. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. William Schaffner, there's a registered nurse, healthcare professional in New York, says she's going to be required to get the vaccination and doesn't want it. There was a rally in Albany. Hundreds of people showed up to protest the plan to get state workers to get the swine flu vaccination and the annual flu shot. On the other hand, you would think that she's not on the front line. Even so, healthcare workers, surely, if anyone's going to need to get this, it would be them. Why the resistance there?
Well, Tom, I hear Wendy's anxiety, and what she needs is someone local to provide the kind of reassurance and information that Michael and I are trying to provide here through the airwaves. Vaccinating healthcare workers, let's get this straight, is a patient safety issue. We want to make sure that no healthcare worker, if they should get infected with influenza, transmits that influenza virus to their patients with cancer, their patients with heart disease, and the like. So patients come first, and we should all be vaccinated against influenza annually. It's both a professional and an ethical responsibility. Yes, the state of New York has now mandated this, and so have increasingly other healthcare systems around the country, and I suspect we'll see more of that going to the future. Wendy needs some consultation. There are distinctive and very few medical contraindications to influenza vaccine. She needs to get her local physician to give her advice about that.
Michael Osterholm, one of the issues that people have come to hold around vaccination in general, unfortunately, is a concern over timolol, the mercury, ethyl mercury that's been used in vaccines so that they can put the needle into the same vial again and again to distribute it and not be spreading some kind of infection that way or disease that way. Is the mercury in these dose vials a problem or not?
Well, first of all, let's take a step back, and I think what you heard in Wendy's question and comments, which are very legitimate and very heartfelt, and we're seeing this with a whole lot of people out there. She said things like, I don't trust the government. Somebody who's mandating this is not getting it, or at least that's what's reported to be happening. And one of the problems we're having today in the overall world of vaccination mm-hmm. is there's much emotion and misinformation that then comes up against the science. And if you're trying to basically put those two together, that doesn't mean mean that science or throwing facts at the situation wins. Because, in fact, if it's a held emotion, that's the way it is. Now you put in this situation with H1N1, and you have that same overlay of concern about vaccines. Does it cause autism? Does it cause other serious side effects, et cetera? And it's hard to try to, in shows like this or with just the general public, to basically address those fears. Bottom line is thimerosal. This is a preservative, as you talked about. It has been studied and studied and studied. And today, if I'm a parent with a child with autism, you clearly have a desire to know why, what happened, what can we do. I mean, that is human nature, and it's a very legitimate feeling to have. And unfortunately, far too often, you reach for one of those things that others have said this could be it. And so we have a lot of people who are very, very holding close to their heart the fact that this autism was caused by this vaccine, and it had to do with something like thimerosal. And I can only tell you, as objectively, as someone with children, and now soon to hopefully have a healthy grandchild, I've looked at this. Others have looked at this from the scientific community, and exhaustively certain medical organizations have looked at this, and we have no evidence whatsoever that these kinds of things have caused any adverse impact to our children. None.
And less mercury here in a dose of this than in a tuna sandwich, I'm reading. I mean, I hope that's right. But.
Right. Well, there's different kinds of mercury and how they act in the body. But the point is, we live in a world of chemicals. There's over 80,000-some chemicals in the environment today that are largely man-made when we live in it. What we have to figure out are which of those are of concern, at what dose, and how do they affect us, and which of those are very good if we don't have them. I mean, you know, cancer drugs are probably the cutting-edge issue. Cancer drugs are very toxic to the human body, but thank God we have them, because for what they do, they basically have made a lot of people still be alive.
Michael Osterholm in Minneapolis with that rut of time, and Dr. William Schaffner in Nashville at Vanderbilt. I hope we can come back and talk to you as the flu season unfolds. The message today, get the vaccination. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, RTI International, a nonprofit research and development organization celebrating 50 years of serving governments and businesses worldwide. More information at rti.org. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing. ConstantContact.com. This is NPR.